I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We begin today in September 1944.
All American news brings you our people's contribution to America and freedom.
Here, our boys are manning 105mm howitzers. The Nazis are entrenched in the foothills, but it won't be long now until this constant barrage will rout them out of their foxhole. Meanwhile, Negro quartermaster troops move up needed supplies to the firing line. Within easy range of enemy guns, they haul up rations, gasoline, ammunition, and medical equipment. The constant barrage and the constant supply train work hand in hand to scatter the Germans. Yes, the enemy has been decisively defeated. But the war is not over, not by a long way. There's never a dull moment, and so our boys move ahead, right on the heels of the fleeing Nazis.
That was a report from Italy, as the troops of the U.S. Army's all-black 92nd Infantry Division fought their way towards Rome. But it was a report that only Black America would have seen at the time. To most Americans, the more than 1 million Black Americans who served in the U.S. Armed Forces during World War II were practically invisible. Matthew Delmont has set out to tell their stories. He's the Sherman Fairchild Distinguished Professor of History at Dartmouth College, and he's the author of a new book, Half American, The Epic Story of African Americans Fighting World War II at Home and Abroad. Matthew Delmont, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Kimberly. Thanks for having me.
So why did you write this book?
I wrote this book because I think this is a history more Americans need to understand. I'm a historian. I'm a professional historian, and I teach history at the college level at Dartmouth College. And I've taught about this history for more than a decade. But as I was going through archival sources, going through Black newspapers, I kept coming across stories of average Black Americans who were drafted or volunteered to serve in the Army, the Navy, and the Marines. And these were not famous people. These were just average African-Americans from Pittsburgh, from Cleveland, from Chicago. And I was blown away by how many of these stories I saw. And it really made me pause and take a step back. This is about 6 or 7 years ago when I started working on this project. It made me wonder, what does the war look like from the African-American perspective? And once I paused and kind of really got into the research, I was amazed at how much material was there. When you actually take a step back and understand what the more than a million Black Americans who participated in the war effort, what they did, and how vital they were to the war effort. It was a story that blew me away, and it's why I was excited to have a chance to write the book.
And so tell us what the title means, Half American.
So the title of the book, Half American, is taken from a letter that was written by a man named James Thompson. James Thompson was a 26-year-old from Wichita, Kansas, and shortly after the bombing of Pearl Harbor in December of 1941, he writes a letter to the Pittsburgh Courier, which was the largest and most influential Black newspaper. In his letter, Thompson asks, "Should I sacrifice my life to live half American? Is the America I know worth defending?" And those words, they just stuck with me for the time I was working on this book. Should I sacrifice my life to live half American? Because what Thompson was wondering is, what does it mean for him and other Black Americans to be drafted into a military that's segregated and to fight for a country that treats him as half American, treats him as a second-class citizen? The Courier uses Thompson's letter to launch the Double Victory Campaign, which is the rallying cry for Black Americans during the war. They're calling for victory over fascism abroad, but also victory over racism at home. And so for me, that title, Half American, it really speaks to what not only James Thompson, but really all Black Americans were asking during that time period. What does it mean to fight for a country that isn't going to treat you fully as an American?
So give us some more context around this double victory campaign. Let's go back to the 30s and early 40s, the lead up to the war. What did Black Americans think about the burgeoning war as even before America got involved?
I think one of the things that's different when you look at the war from the African-American perspective is that the war really starts before Pearl Harbor. If you look at a Black newspaper from 1933, 34, 35, you'd see extensive coverage of what's going on in Europe. Black Americans are among the first to recognize the really dire threat that Adolf Hitler and the Nazis pose, not just to Europe, not just to Jews in Europe, but really to the world. There are editorials and articles already in the early and mid-1930s that call it explicitly the ways in which Hitler and the Nazis are drawing on American racial policies to justify their treatment of Jews in Europe. They're drawing parallels between the segregation of Jews on train cars, the theft of Jewish property, the violence against Jewish communities in Europe, and how closely that resembles the kind of treatment Black Americans are receiving in the Jim Crow South. And so these editorials are powerful evidence that Black Americans understood what a dire threat Nazism and fascism posed to the world, and they were ready to take up arms to fight against it. The challenge, of course, in the 1930s for Black Americans is that the military does almost everything they can to push Black Americans out of the service of their country. And so as Black Americans are recognizing this threat internationally, they also have to fight domestically just to have a chance to even participate in the military effort.
Yeah, so you were talking about this double victory campaign, and it involved a lot of things that even we saw in subsequent civil rights protests, such as the 1963 March on Washington. That came out of the wartime civil rights movement. A. Philip Randolph, the Black labor leader, used a threat of a march in 1941 to force President Franklin Roosevelt into action.
I called for a conference with the president. The president as his first comment, he said, Phil Randolph, we can't have 100,000 Negroes marching on Washington. If anything such as that were to occur, you wouldn't be able to manage them. We might have bloodshed and death. He said, now let us get on to business here and find out what can be done.
Matt, what came out of that meeting between A. Philip Randolph and President Roosevelt in the 40s?
So the result of that meeting between Randolph and the president is that the president issues an executive order, Executive Order 8802, which calls for an end to discrimination in the defense industries and establishes something called the Fair Employment Practices Commission, the FEPC. It's really important at the time because as America's preparing to lead into the war, Roosevelt says that the United States is going to be the arsenal of democracy. And so what that means functionally is there's going to be millions and millions of war jobs, and Black Americans want to make sure that they have a chance to participate in that defense buildup and be able to benefit from those war jobs. And so Randolph, by threatening this march on Washington, does a couple things. He gets the president to sign this executive order, but also really lays the foundation for what it means for Black Americans to come together, organize, and demonstrate their political power. The march itself is called off as part of this negotiation for the executive order, but it really lays the foundation for activism not only throughout the war, but well into the 1960s. As you noted, it provides the blueprint for the 1963 March on Washington.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about the debate within the Black community about the war. Was there disagreement on whether it was a good idea to go fight in World War II?
There was disagreement within the Black community. And obviously, the Black community has never been monolithic, and that was true with the war as well. On one hand, most mainstream civil rights leaders and most of the Black newspapers were in favor of Black Americans fighting the war effort. They recognized the real threat that Nazi Germany posed, and then after Pearl Harbor, they recognized that America needed to fight back against Japan. They also recognize that service in the military has been one of the core aspects of what it means to be fully American. And so the people who were in favor of Black Americans participating in the war thought that this military service in World War II would help to lay the foundation for equal citizenship after the war. But there is a significant chorus of voices who oppose African American involvement in the war, particularly people who are a pacifist or who hold more radical political opinions, who don't think the United States during the war is worth fighting for. And in many ways, they have a point. They're pointing to the fact that the United States racial policies are apartheid-like policies. The Black Americans in the South can't vote. Black Americans across the country are facing racial discrimination in terms of housing, in terms of employment, in terms of schools. And they're asking pointedly, should we even fight for this country? More broadly, they're worried about how the United States and its allies, particularly Great Britain, are trying to use the war to perpetuate colonial policies. And so there are a significant chorus of voices who argue that Black Americans should not participate in the war effort. Ultimately, once the draft happens, Black Americans are compelled to participate in the war effort, and the vast majority of Black Americans take up that the draft status and join the military.
And talk a little bit more about the atmosphere in the United States on the home front at that time. What was the job situation like for many Black Americans? And how did that intersect with first the decision, the deliberation about whether to fight, and then the draft?
So in the lead up to the war, so before Pearl Harbor, Black Americans are experiencing discrimination all across the country. It's most pronounced in the South, where you would see the explicit forms of Jim Crow segregation, the white drinking fountains, the Black drinking fountains, clearly segregated schools. But that discrimination is true across the country as well. Whether you're in New York, in Chicago, Minneapolis, Los Angeles, Black Americans are experiencing discrimination in almost every facet of their life, particularly in terms of employment. Black Americans just don't have the same access to jobs and even to labor unions as white Americans have. That is a cause of significant frustration and anger for Black Americans. And so it's clear that civil rights activism is already taking place well before the war starts. It only escalates during the war as the war really heightens the intensity around racial discrimination. After Pearl Harbor, once the United States enters the war, more opportunities start to open up, particularly in terms of employment in the war industries, because there are so many white American men who are drafted into service that leaves a number of potential job openings in the defense industries. But even there, it takes consistent town by town, city by city, workplace by workplace activism by Black Americans to get their foot in the door, to get a chance to have some of these war jobs. And the kind of steady through line throughout is that the kind of persistent racial violence Black Americans experience at the hands of white citizens and the police really continues, in some cases escalates during the war. And so World War II is really a fraught racial period. I think for some Americans, they like to look back and think World War II is a simpler time, but the reality is it just was not.
I'm speaking with Matthew Delmont, author of the new book, Half American, the epic story of African Americans fighting World War II at home and abroad. Matthew, stay with us. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, I'm joined by Matthew Delmont, history professor at Dartmouth College and the author of a new book, Half American, the epic story of African Americans fighting World War II at home and abroad. So, Matthew, once the war began and Black men started signing up for the fight, they were faced with specific challenges even before they made it to the battlefield, just when they got to training. Talk a little bit about what they encountered there.
The important thing to understand is that the entire military is segregated throughout the war. So within the Army, Black troops are largely blocked from combat roles. They're largely put in supply and logistical units. And everything within the Army is segregated. They segregate the residence halls and the barracks and the cafeterias and even the recreation facilities. Within the Navy, Black Americans can only participate in the messman branch initially, where they wait on and serve white officers. And at the start of the war, Black Americans aren't allowed in the Marine Corps at all. It's not until a year or two into the war that Black Americans first have the opportunity to participate in the Marines. So what these Black troops experience once they volunteer or are drafted is that they are put on trains and sent to Army camps, which are largely based in the South. And the stories you hear from particularly those who are coming from outside of the South, places like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, is that they get to the demarcation points in the South, Washington, D.C., or other cities, and then have to transfer to the segregated Jim Crow part of the train. And so they're wearing their military uniforms, they've just been drafted or volunteered for service, but they're already being put into segregated parts of the train. When those trains pull into these southern towns, they describe having to pull the shades down so that the white townspeople wouldn't throw rocks at the train because they were so upset about the idea of Black Americans coming to be part of the war effort. Once they get placed on these military bases, they describe daily harassment by their white officers and other white enlisted men, being called racial epithets every day and being threatened physically and sometimes beaten while they're on the base. Things were so bad that Black Americans, these troops, start to write letters to the NAACP and to Black newspapers saying that they would feel safer if they were deployed for war in Europe or in the Pacific than being stationed in Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia. And I think it speaks to just the day-to-day reality of what military service meant for these Black Americans, that they wanted to do everything they could to help defend their country, but they were honestly concerned for their lives from threats of violence from their own countrymen before they even ever had a chance to deploy for the war.
I want to talk a little bit more about the racism experienced by Black servicemen. Lieutenant John Lear was a member of the Tuskegee Airmen, and he spoke of his experience one night after training.
Just outside Birmingham or something, we stopped by a policeman, and he said, you know, stopped us, pulled us over, and for no reason at all, just because, where you going? And I told him, we're not officers of the United States Army Air Corps. And he pulled his pistol out and put it to my temple. You say one more word and I'm going to blow your goddamn brains out. And we're on a little old rural road out there, and he'd have done it just like that. I mean, he was standing there trembling with a gun at my temple.
So, Matt, I mean, for a lot of these servicemen, the idea of being in that experience was probably more frightening than actually going across the world and being on a war field.
Exactly. What Black veterans describe was that at least if you were actually at war in Germany or in Japan, you knew who the enemy was and you could defend yourself. On these army bases, whether they were on base or whether they were traveling into these small southern towns, they didn't feel like they could defend themselves. And they felt like almost any white citizen, whether it was a sheriff, a police officer, or even a bus driver who was deputized to behave as though they were a sheriff, was empowered to implement and make sure that the Jim Crow policies of the South, the racism of the South, extended to Black enlisted men and to Black officers. And there was almost a feeling of helplessness at the hands of these white townspeople and the white officers there on the bases, because these Black troops had been sent to the army bases. They wanted to do what they could to defend the country, but the sort of daily threats that they experienced were horrific. And I appreciate playing the clip from Tuskegee, because I think for a lot of people, they think of the Tuskegee Airmen, who are among the most well-known Black Americans to participate in the war effort. They were the trailblazing Black pilots. But when you read their accounts of being in Tuskegee, Alabama, and listen to those oral histories, what they experienced at home was terrifying before they even ever had a chance to go abroad and to fight the Nazis.
And the Tuskegee Airmen were one of the few Black men who got into combat roles, or one of the first to get into combat roles. Talk a little bit about the Tuskegee Airmen.
So one of the characters I feature in the book is a man named Benjamin O. Davis, Jr. Davis graduated from West Point in 1936, and at the time he was only the fourth Black man to ever graduate from West Point, and the first in the 20th century. But when he graduates from West Point in 1936, the Army has no idea what to do with him, because Davis wants to be a pilot, but at that time the Army Air Corps isn't allowing any Black Americans to be pilots. And so it's not until May of 1941, after extensive protests from Black civil rights activists and Black newspapers, that the Army finally establishes a flight training center for Black pilots at Tuskegee. And Davis is one of the first members of the cohort to train there, and he becomes the leader of the 99th Fighter Squadron, the first group of Tuskegee Airmen. What's unique about their experience is they have to train for nearly 2 years before they're deployed to combat. So whereas white pilots are training for 6 weeks or 8 weeks before they're deployed to Europe or the Pacific, the Tuskegee Airmen are just left here in Alabama flying training mission after training mission while living in this very, very hostile situation. Davis himself describes it as being a condition of unfairness with demeaning insults and raw discrimination part of daily life. And so for them, they were truly kind of fighting the two aspects of the double victory campaign. They wanted to prepare to be able to fight in combat, but they were dealing with extensive racism at home. Finally, by spring of 1943, they deployed to the Mediterranean and have their first experience in combat. They're accompanying bombers on raids against Nazi targets. And they perform extremely well. But the problem then is that some of their white commanders still don't want Black pilots in the service. And so their white commanders write after-action reports that seek to undercut them. And so they say that these Tuskegee Airmen pilots were not courageous in combat, that they don't have what it takes to be fighter pilots. And this becomes a media controversy where some of the mainstream press, Time and Newsweek, pick up these reports from white commanders and openly disparage the Tuskegee Airmen while black papers are coming to their defense. And so it was really a month-by-month battle that the Tuskegee Airmen fought, not only against Nazi pilots, but in some cases against their own commanders to prove that they had what it took.
I want to talk a little bit about what service members before they were allowed into combat roles, or those who never served in combat roles, what black servicemen did. What other roles did they fill?
So the largest and most important roles black troops played were in the supply and logistical forces within the Army, Navy, and Marines. And so what this meant is that in all theaters of operation across the world, it was really black troops who were crucial to moving supplies. This would be loading ships, loading trucks, and then driving those trucks. In the case of D-Day, for example, after the D-Day invasion, there was a group of black truck drivers called the Red Ball Express who transported hundreds of thousands of tons of supplies across Europe to help supply the Army forces as they're moving into Germany. It's that behind-the-scenes, very kind of unglamorous work that black troops were doing that made it possible for the America and the Allies to fight and win this global war. Because, of course, to be able to fight on all these different battlefronts, you have to be able to move ammunition and gasoline and food and boots and clothing and uniforms. You have to be able to move that to all parts of the globe. And it was really black Americans who were key to this logistical effort. And so one of the things they tried to make clear in the book was that World War II was not just a battle of strategy and will, it was a battle of supply. And when you take that perspective, the really vital role that black Americans played to help winning the war effort comes into clearer view.
And once the troops were on the battlefield, in the fight, filling these logistical roles, what sort of racism did they encounter there? Was it much like they experienced at home in training, or was it different?
In most cases, their experience of racism improved once they deployed, in part because then the focus was squarely on fighting the war. And so I don't want to say that racial discrimination wasn't still there in the European theater and the Pacific theater, because of course it was. But by and large, the stories they tell is that once the war was actually going on, once they were actually in battle, there was a more of a sense of unity, more of a sense of shared goals to win those battles. And then almost as soon as the battle ended, then the Jim Crow policies, the racism came back into the foreground.
And were their experiences different in Europe versus in the Pacific?
They were. So particularly for black Americans meeting Europeans, British and French people, the descriptions that black veterans give of encountering white Europeans was extraordinarily positive. They said that the kind of treatment they received from white Europeans was far and away better than the kind of treatment they had received from white Americans. One of the, I think, best-known stories or stories I recount in the book is that Medgar Evers, a very important civil rights activist, he was only 19 or 20. He was deployed to Normandy. He meets a white family as his unit's moving across France, and he says it's the first time that he ever felt like he was treated as a full human being by a white person, just meeting this French family. And that dramatically changes his worldview. And when he goes back to Mississippi, it makes him fight all the harder for equal rights for himself and for other black Mississippians.
Mm. And talk a little bit about the efforts, the civil rights efforts that were ongoing during the war. What were groups like the NAACP and others fighting for during World War II for black service members?
So throughout the war, the NAACP really builds into a large national organization that has the capacity to fight on behalf of black Americans. One of the most important figures there would be Ella Baker, who goes on to pioneer grassroots leadership styles that influence generations of activists all the way into the 1960s with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and even up through Black Lives Matter activists in recent years. But what Ella Baker does is she travels throughout the country teaching local black people how to form branches and how to recruit members to the NAACP. And so by the end of the war, the NAACP has increased dramatically in terms of size. They have 1,000 branches and more than 450,000 members by the end of the war. And what those members are fighting for, what Ella Baker and other civil rights activists are fighting for, are voting rights, particularly in the South, making sure black Americans have the opportunity to vote. They're fighting for equal access to employment, making sure that the war jobs that have emerged, the opportunities Black Americans have during the war, don't go away at the end of the war. And they start to lay the foundation for fighting for school desegregation as well. And some of those cases show up later into the 1950s, particularly with Brown versus Board in 1954. In terms of Black soldiers and veterans, the NAACP is really crucial to trying to make sure that Black troops are not being harassed and being attacked and being killed in some cases on these military bases in the South. And so Thurgood Marshall and other members of the NAACP are investigating these cases of violence and trying to do everything they can to make sure military leaders and politicians are held to account.
Yeah. And all the while, talk a little bit about what is happening on the home front while these Black service members are deployed. You don't just have civil rights activists like Ella Baker working, but Black women, the lives of Black women changed tremendously too during that time.
Exactly. So there's more than a million Black Americans who participate in the defense industries. And of those, 600,000 are Black women. And the stories they describe is that this opened up job opportunities that just were not possible before the war. And so a common refrain was, it was the war that helped get Black women out of white women's kitchens. Because before the war, domestic work, particularly in white households, was one of the primary forms of employment that was available to Black women outside of the home. And so all of a sudden you have hundreds of thousands of Black women working on assembly lines, making tanks and trains and ammunition that are going to help win the war effort. That's important because these are well-paying jobs, and so there's a real tangible economic benefit for fighting for these jobs and fighting for employment. And there's also a matter of respect that comes with it. And so being able to do this kind of work that's recognized not only within Black communities but in the larger American community, recognizing the really vital nature of those jobs to the war effort brings a measure of respect that wasn't available in terms of employment for a lot of Black women or Black Americans prior to the war. The other aspect of this story with the defense industries is there's always a kind of back and forth push. And so as soon as you see Black women getting a chance to get into these defense industry jobs, there are organized protests on behalf of white war workers who are upset by this progress. And so even if something as small as a dozen Black workers getting jobs on a factory floor or being promoted, or even something as small as desegregating the toilets at a factory, led to strikes on behalf of white workers to try to make sure that the status quo racial hierarchy was kept in place. And so it's a really kind of fraught period of racial tension on the factory floor as Black Americans are trying to get their share of these war jobs.
And you are anticipating my next question, which even as the war was ongoing back at home, was there a sense that racial attitudes were changing at all, or were they, in fact, becoming more hardened, more entrenched?
If anything, racial attitudes became more entrenched during the war. And I think this is where the perspective on what the war was about is really different for Black Americans than it was for white Americans. For Black Americans, as I mentioned, it was about the double victory campaign. They wanted to win militarily, but they also wanted to uproot white supremacy and racial discrimination at home. For most white Americans, based on the quotes they give, based on public polling, based on the recollections of white veterans, what they want is a return to how things were before the start of the war. What that meant, unfortunately, was a return to the status quo and a return to racial hierarchies. And so in many ways, they were fighting a single victory campaign. They wanted military victory and then a return to the way America had been. That was the exact opposite, though, of what Black Americans wanted. They didn't want to return to a country that treated them as half American. They didn't want to return to a country that treated them as second-class citizens. And these competing visions of what America should be really come to a head during the war. In 1943, for example, there are more than 240 race riots or racial clashes all across the country in cities and towns and on military bases. And so when we look back today, and some people would say that World War II was a more unified or simpler time, it simply isn't true. That sort of factually, we know that there was as much racial tension then as we might be seeing now. And the reason for that is that there were just very different beliefs or understandings about how America should approach the issue of race. You had one set of people who believed in racial hierarchies and another set of people who desperately believed in racial equality.
Matthew Delmont is the Sherman Fairchild Distinguished Professor of History at Dartmouth College and the author of Half American, the epic story of African Americans fighting World War II at home and abroad. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, I'm joined by Matthew Delmont, professor of history at Dartmouth College and author of Half American, the epic story of African Americans fighting World War II at home and abroad. I want to return to the home front for a second. Countless people upended their lives to go work in factories, shipyards, and military bases. People like Betty Reed Soskin from Oakland, California. As the war effort ramped up, Betty found work in the Kaiser Corporation's new Richmond shipyards, just north of her hometown. Her job was to keep the labor union's card files up to date with workers' addresses. It was tedious work, but it represented an enormous leap for Betty's prospects, as she told an audience at the National World War II Museum in 2013.
I was a clerk. You have to understand that my parents were very, very pleased and proud of me because this was a step up. As a young woman of color, I could have either worked in agriculture or I could have been a domestic servant. That was the extent of it. I was a very naive 20-year-old, changing addresses to save the world on 3x5 cards.
All the shipyard workers at Kaiser had to be union members, but as Betty recalled, that didn't mean that every union member was equal.
When the war broke out, the unions were not, labor unions were not yet racially integrated, so that the border makers organized 3 separate unions that were auxiliaries into which all African Americans were placed with dues, but no power, no votes.
But while racial division coursed through the operation, it also gave some black workers a taste of future freedoms.
Henry Kaiser had come into a city with a population of 23,000 people and brought in a workforce of 98,000 black and white people who wouldn't be sharing drinking fountains or schools or any public accommodations or hospitals for another 20 years back in their places of origin. Can you imagine the kinds of social dynamics that were set in motion?
Not only had it been crucial to the war effort, but the site also had huge societal significance. At Richmond, the Kaiser Corporation provided free childcare and heavily subsidized housing and medical insurance. Richmond is now seen as a laboratory for the modern-day welfare programs, the origin of Head Start and Kaiser Permanente. It was also important that in the year 2000, it was decided to preserve the shipyard as Rosie the Riveter National Park. Betty served on the committee establishing the park, and she pointed out one glaring issue. Black workers at the shipyards were either excluded from these programs or forced to use segregated facilities.
I could not relate to the Rosie the Riveter story because that woman whose picture you see of I Can Do It was a white woman's story. All of those sites were sites of segregation.
To ensure visitors understood the complete story of the park, Betty decided to become a park ranger at the age of 85. She served in the park until March of this year when she retired from the National Park Service a few months before her 101st birthday. Matt, tell us a little bit more about life on the home front. We started talking about it a little bit in the last segment, but even though the war effort promoted Black women like Betty into the workplace, it certainly was not equal.
Exactly. And I think that's a great clip to play because it speaks to realities of what the home front was about, that World War II upended almost everything in American society. A whole set of things seemed possible that didn't seem possible even a few years before. You have mass migrations of both Black and white workers moving from the South to other parts of the country pursuing these war jobs, putting people into work situations and living situations that hadn't existed previously, sometimes positively and sometimes negatively. You have whole host of Black workers who have opportunities in the workplace for earning potential for development of skills that hadn't been possible a few years before. And that opens up possibilities for what might come after the war. And then you have possibilities in terms of organizing, the March on Washington and the executive order that Roosevelt passes, the demonstration of Black political power that comes out of wartime era civil rights organizing, and the voting potential of Black voters, the way that the Democratic Party has to finally pay attention to the demands of Black voters, and the Republican Party is seeing Black voters as potentially their chance to get FDR out of the White House. All those things are true on the home front. They're all crucially important. But at the same time, you still have deep, deep racial tensions across the country. Black Americans can't get mortgages to live in most neighborhoods, and that's not just in the South. That's in New York, in New Jersey, in Minnesota, in California. These war industries where Black workers are getting their opportunities, they're also sites of intense racial animosity. You have organized efforts with groups that are linked to the KKK organizing on shop floors, holding strikes to protest and try to get Black workers excluded from these job opportunities. And then all across the country, you have reports of Black troops and Black citizens being threatened and harassed and in some cases shot and killed on buses if they don't comply with the Jim Crow policies of moving to the back of the bus. And so during the war era on the home front, it's a crucible that you have a set of opportunities that hadn't been possible previously and Black Americans want to take advantage of that. But you also have a significant feeling of retrenchment and a whole host of white Americans who want to make sure that the racial hierarchies that existed prior to the war remain in place.
And the welcome that Black servicemen got when they returned to the home front was also different from their white counterparts. William Holloman, one of the Tuskegee Airmen, spoke about the harsh return to Jim Crow after the war.
When the war ended and we came back to the States, the most amazing thing, I remember this for the rest of my life. We were coming down the gangplank, getting off the boat. Now there were more Blacks on the boat coming back because they brought our group back together. And they had a sign at the bottom of the gangplank. Whites to one side, colored to the other side.
Matt, that must have been quite a rude awakening for these servicemen returning from the battlefield.
As a historian, some of the hardest things to listen to read in these historical sources are those accounts of the utter disrespect that Black veterans received when they returned to the country. That story of being separated when they came off of ships was a common one. Another story I ran across frequently in the archives was Black troops arriving in towns but not being allowed to march through the town as the white troops would. They were sent on a circuitous path only through the Black community. It was utterly disrespectful the way that America received these Black veterans. And even worse, there were at least a dozen black veterans who were murdered in the years immediately following the war, some while still wearing their military uniforms. And the reason for that was that too many white communities recognized that these black veterans were going to be leaders in the civil rights movement. They were going to come home and demand equal treatment. They're going to come home and demand actual freedom, democracy, the freedom and democracy they've been fighting for. And that made them threats. The reason it's so upsetting is because these black veterans gave everything they could to the war effort. They fought for the country. They saw their friends killed fighting in the war. And they came back and were treated in some ways worse than when they left. At a policy level, the GI Bill perpetuated much of that discrimination. It is the main piece of policy legislation that helped white veterans move into the middle class, but it had racial discrimination provisions in the way it was implemented that harmed black veterans as well. And so across all aspects of treatment, whether it was the kind of respect shown, whether it was the violence they faced, or whether it was the policies and the benefits that were accessible to them, black veterans just were not treated the same as white veterans when they came back to the United States.
So you frame this as a double victory, that black Americans were fighting. One, the war itself, and the other was the fight for equality back on the home front. So when these service members returned after the war, it would still be nearly two decades before the Civil Rights Act would be passed. What did that fight on the home front look like? What were black Americans and white Americans who were a part of that fight doing at that time?
The way black veterans put it is they went from fighting in the European theater of operations to fighting in the Southern theater of operations. And so basically, as soon as the war ends in 1945, it doesn't end for black Americans. That the military aspect of the war ends, but the fight at home continues and it escalates. And so that whole generation of black veterans becomes leaders in the civil rights movement. Folks like Medgar Evers, Jose Williams, Oliver Brown, W. Johnson Roundtree. They all become crucial participants in the civil rights movement. And what that looks like across the country is you have new organizations forming or new branches of existing organizations forming, people coming together locally to fight for the issues that are most important confronting them in their communities. The ones that were most paramount were voting rights, school segregation, access to employment, and then housing. The kind of housing discrimination black Americans experienced was an affront and was a tremendous harm on wealth creation. But it's through those organizing efforts, the work of black veterans, black citizens and their white allies to demand that states and the country actually produce meaningful legislation that's going to produce racial equality. This was a month-by-month battle that these black veterans and other activists and citizens fought. And it was a series, much like a military battle, of moving forward for a period of time and then facing retrenchment. But they were persistent in their efforts to try to make sure that the kind of freedom and democracy they fought for abroad was going to be true for them at home as well.
And this battle to end segregation in industry and in factories in other places, it's really hard to underscore, to state just how transformative this was at that time. I mean, my grandparents moved from the South to the North to work in factories in places like Michigan, like Iowa, in the 1940s because those opportunities were not available before. And you write about in the book the fact that the NAACP and other civil rights groups were growing just at warp speed, both in their membership and in their work at that time. Talk a little more about that.
So Ella Baker, who I mentioned previously, is really the key to expanding NAACP membership. So at the start of the war, they have 50,000 members and 350 branches. By the end of the war, there's 1,000 branches and 450,000 members. And what that makes possible is a infrastructure of civil rights activism all across the country. And so just as new opportunities are opening up in terms of employment, in terms of trying to get more neighborhood integration, you also have the infrastructure to make sure that those advances that have been achieved aren't lost and that new advances are continually being fought for. I think that's one of the important things of understanding the civil rights movement, particularly as it comes out of the war, is that it's not about any single person. I think oftentimes when we talk about the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, it's easy to focus on the iconic leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. But this was a local movement driven by local people. And so part of what Baker pioneered was her belief that you didn't need a single male leader to move civil rights forward, but you needed a community of leadership. You needed a leader-full movement where you could have thousands and thousands of people all across the country fighting together for the civil rights advances. And that's what I think is so powerful and inspiring about the civil rights movement that comes out of the war, is that it's truly a national movement comprised of local people fighting on behalf of their communities and truly fighting to make America a better, more equitable place.
And people think about World War II. We think about the troops coming home and things like the GI Bill, making it easier for them to get jobs and find housing and things like that. But of course, it was not so easy for Black Americans.
Exactly. The GI Bill is perhaps the most important piece of legislation our country's ever passed. It's what made it possible for a whole generation of white veterans to enter the middle class, because it provided access to low-income or low-interest home loans, to business loans, college tuition benefits, and a host of other benefits. It's really what fueled the rise of the middle class in the United States, and what made it possible for that generation of white veterans to re-enter the country. It was payback for the service they'd provided to the country. Unfortunately, the way that the GI Bill legislation was written, it was distributed at the state and local level, and that was by design. Southern Democrats, who wrote large parts of the legislation, understood that if it was distributed locally at the state level, that meant that racial discrimination could be part of how it was distributed. And so there are countless stories from the 1940s of Black veterans trying to access their GI Bill benefits and being turned away or being given the runaround. In terms of the VA-backed mortgages, that was true outside the South as well, that Black veterans just could not access them in the same way that white veterans could. To cite just one example, of the 67,000 mortgages that were issued by the VA in New York and Northern New Jersey in 1947, fewer than 100 went to Black veterans. Nationally, by 1950, white veterans had received nearly 98% of these VA-guaranteed home loans. That had a really significant long-term impact in terms of the kind of wealth Black veterans could generate from these benefits. The Institute for Economic and Racial Equity at Brandeis University has done some recent calculations on what the long-term impact of this has been. And what they found is that Black veterans' GI Bill benefits were worth, on average, only about 40% of what white veterans received. And over a lifetime, that was about a $100,000 difference. And so when we see these, what should be upsetting figures about the vast racial wealth gap in our country, a large part of that can be traced back to the GI Bill and the way it was implemented. And I think the last piece I've mentioned here is that there were thousands of Black veterans who were able to access their GI Bill benefits. And I think the story we can take from that is that these veterans went on to do amazing things. W. Johnson Roundtree was a Women's Army Corps veteran. She established a law firm in Washington, D.C. and helped win really important civil rights cases in the 1950s. And then a guy named Robert P. Madison was a lieutenant in the Army. He used the GI Bill to earn architectural degrees from Case Western and Harvard and went on to establish a trailblazing architectural firm. And so this discrimination really prevented the country from benefiting from a whole generation of Black professionals.
Matthew's book, Half American, The Epic Story of African Americans Fighting World War II at Home and Abroad, is available now. Matthew Delmont, Sherman Fairchild Distinguished Professor of History at Dartmouth College, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Kimberly. It was a pleasure talking with you.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.